So, Birdo, Chapter 4, Pandemic Review, let's continue. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Umberto Castaneda, and I enforce the accuracy of digital clocks.
I want to return. I want to go back in time to early March because I actually looked up some emails, exchanges at my work to figure out exactly what was said because I think that it's interesting to me anyway.
Right, right, right.
I don't know if any of this is interesting to the listeners, but like I've been saying, this is therapeutic for me. So going back in time to March 2nd, this is a Monday, and this is the day that I decide to go on Zoom. But it seemed to me in my memory that no one else or very few other professors were making right. that choice. And then it was just a week later where the entire Antioch campus, quote unquote, temporarily closed. But so I looked in my emails and there was an email from the acting chair at the time, my boss. It was among us in our program, like 15 different professors, and there was an email exchange, and my boss said, a few students are concerned about the coronavirus and want to Zoom into class. Should we let them? My boss is asking that, okay. right? And doesn't it sound a little like, well...
Yeah, I mean, like, why are you being so freaky about this?
Yeah. Now, my boss is a wonderful person. Yeah, she's very, you know, this is Michelle, if some of my colleagues are listening. She was acting as...
This was a lot of people's belief at that time.
Yeah. A few students are concerned about the coronavirus and want to Zoom into class. Should we let them? Because the general rule was you have to attend class.
Right.
We're pretty much, very much sticklers for attendance in class, obviously. But there were a lot of responses, but one response, which kind of reflected everyone, is, look, if they're uncomfortable, then I'm allowing it for now. So again, it's not that these individuals who are expressing concerns are right.
Right.
It's that...
We'll
indulge their worries because right. they're having a freak out, whatever. You know, right. it's not that bad, but it's in that direction.
Sure.
So that was my memory, was that it wasn't a problem to my colleagues and even to the vast majority of students at this point. Whereas for you, you were freaking out already for a month because you were much
right,
more
right.
in tune with the actual data.
But I still had people. What day is this? March?
2nd.
2nd. Yeah. I mean... Plenty of people at work, I was even saying, there was a high up manager that was like, yeah, this is going to blow over. You know?
Right. And then I sent out an email that day and I said, I don't know if this is an overreaction or not, but let's just have class over Zoom. I feel like I'm having to apologize.
Right.
Because I honestly thought.
I might look ridiculous for doing this.
Yeah, because I was worried that everyone's going to be like, oh, come on, Kirk.
Right.
You're a germaphobe. Relax. So I say, I don't know if this is an overreaction or not, but let's just have class over Zoom. And a couple students replied saying, yeah, I was kind of concerned as well. Then March 5th, which is just a few days later, my campus president sent out an email saying, given the nature of our campus and important differences between what we do and a campus like Amazon's, we will continue to hold classes on our campus. However, we ask that everyone exercise an abundance of caution, wash hands, maintain distance, avoid touching surfaces, etc. So what do you think about that email, Berto?
Interesting. So basically it's saying, hey, you know, the nature of what we do, we can't just like
right.
be remote.
Right.
But, you know, let's take precautions. Let's, you know... Keep it clean.
Yeah, it just sounds like, yeah, you know, do what you can. Wash yeah. hands, maintain distance. How are you supposed to maintain different distance when you're in a small classroom?
Right. Which, by the way, at the time was the conventional wisdom. I heard that all the time around that time. I remember me thinking, washing my hands. Well, sure. Okay, fair enough. But if someone coughs in my face, what am I supposed to do? Wash
right.
my hands?
I mean, we literally can't open the windows in our classrooms.
Right.
There's no way to open them. So you're just stuck in a hot box with
right.
20 people.
Do you know that I bought at the time, I don't remember exactly, it was like the beginning of March, I ordered copper because I had heard copper kills, you know.
Mm.
So I had ordered this copper wire to wrap around my door handles.
No.
So that whenever I would touch them. And then I actually thought, like, I this is where I was getting a little nutty. I'm like, maybe I could carry a little copper stick with me everywhere. And just, I was like, okay.
I mean, it, at that point, what's the right. to say? I mean, right. maybe 6 months from now, everyone has a bunch of copper in their right. house. Like
a little vial of bleach point, around the neck.
I mean, looking back, it's all looks stupid, but yeah. at that point in the United States, 99% of people didn't do anything ever.
Right.
They didn't wash their hands. I mean, there are people who never washed their hands.
Right. Yeah, it was the extreme opposite.
And so I was actually thinking about this in the interim between last chapter and this, is that there's a lot of bad things to say about the past few years, and there's a lot of losses. There's a lot of death. But one silver lining is the next time we have a pandemic of that ilk, and you could argue we're still in it, obviously, but the next virus that comes along, the next time a lockdown has to happen, the next time we need to all do our part, I'm guessing, and the data seems to show this, that we'll be much faster and more ready to react. Because it's within everyone's interest. It's within, for the people in power, it's within right. the government's interest. It's with, because they want to get reelected. It's within marketers' interest because the economy suffered quite a bit, right?
Yeah.
So the people in power who pull all the strings, they have been trained. You know, we went through this massive on-the-job training for 3 years. That, and then culturally as well, like the adjustment to vaccines and to masks, I think will right. be much quicker.
It is very nice, for example, that you, let's say you're getting a bit of a sniffles, or you heard that there's been a thing going around at work, that it's totally cool if you show up with a mask at work.
Right.
That you might be like, hey, I'm not shaking hands today because there's a thing going around, and no one's going to be like, how rude.
Right. Or stay home.
Yeah.
And zoom in.
Right, right. That exactly. Even that, like, because that was never the case. Like,
no.
You'd be like, wait, Joey is sick. Why are you staying home?
Right.
Because I just don't want to catch it. That's weird. You're weird.
Right.
And wearing a mask would have been unheard of.
You'd be labeled a kook. Yeah. You'd be a total kook, regardless of the reason, you know? Yeah. In the past, it was completely normal for me to be at work and to have someone near me coughing and sneezing and noticeably sick.
Yeah.
And just without any care about what impact it would have on other people. And I was one of maybe one or two people in the room that was not comfortable with that. I wouldn't do anything about it because I didn't want to stick out. But now the culture, at least in most places, has completely shifted, where if you come to work sick, especially if you're visibly sick, people will say, what are you doing?
Yeah,
leave. Get out of here.
Yeah.
And that was never the case in the past.
It depends on the industry, I suppose, but it was a mark of like toughness. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I'm at work, but I'm still at work.
Yeah. Oh, you know, George, he's really dedicated to his work. What a great employee. Yeah. Yeah. So then my boss sent out another email at this point. So this is, again, it's a few days later, March 5th. So this is like Thursday of that week. I don't know if you listen to the New York Times, the Daily podcast, but today's episode was about COVID-19 spread in Washington State. I want to encourage you all to use Zoom and other online platforms to facilitate your classes for the remainder of the quarter. I realize I'm at risk of overreacting to this, but I would rather we be as safe as we can while maintaining our core standards. So
that's
how interesting in 3 days.
Yeah.
Right? That's
big
how fast
shift.
This moved.
Yeah.
That's how fast things changed. Things went from 99% of people going like, oh, come on, it's fine.
Right.
To, I think we have a problem right now.
And last time I was saying how time was kind of weird in those days, because yeah, I had this recollection like, man, I was, you know, upset for a month or whatever, and then you're like, no, it seems like it was only like 9 days later that the school shut down or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
each day was longer as a result of the stress.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Also, I got an email from a student on this day. They're an intern, and they emailed me and said, it looks like Sound, which is Sound Mental Health, which is a local agency, it looks like Sound has issued a mandatory closure of our office and are asking us to work from home. They are allowing me to do therapy over the phone from home. End of email excerpt. And this reminds me of all the just wild adjustments that everyone had to make, because prior to this, and I think we talked about this in previous chapters, that it was completely unheard of to allow agency therapists to
yeah,
to do distance work.
I mean, you said they had to go through training, right? Like they.
Well, not only training, but even if they had gone through training, they wouldn't be allowed to do it.
I see.
It was just considered to be not really therapy.
I see.
Or a cop-out on behalf of the clinician. It was it's just a cultural thing, you know, that you just, it was just a given that it was completely useless as a mode of treatment, which has been found not to be true. I've stated that I personally am not a fan in my world, not only as a therapist, but a professor. But I do recognize that it is a viable delivery method, particularly during this time, because it's like, what else can you do during this time?
Do you perceive it as viable as in, well, if you have no other choices, I guess it'll do in a pinch, or, oh, it can work as effectively?
There's a fair amount of research demonstrating that with training and with a lot of the issues that clients come to therapy for, it's just as effective.
Oh, wow.
I think that doesn't illuminate, you know, because effective outcome research is often based on these very discrete issues in therapy, mm-hmm. like depression symptoms or anxiety symptoms, where you can measure symptom degree over time. And they find that in person or online, if someone knows what they're doing, they have the same rate of symptom reduction compared. I don't quote me on that, but that's usually effectiveness research is usually along those
lines.
Which
I think is probably a surprise to. It's a surprise to me. For example,
depression treatment is a lot of cognition work. It's not a lot of. It can obviously. So my point is that I think the more subtle aspects of effectiveness, so to speak, of therapy aren't very easy to measure, like the effectiveness of an emotional corrective experience, the effectiveness of the therapeutic alliance, the curative nature of feeling like someone truly knows you and cares about you. I think that's harder to measure outcomes, and it's more long term, and so it's more expensive to research. It's not usually what people focus on, but for a lot of people, myself included, the main reason I go to therapy is for that.
Right.
In my personal experience as a therapist and as a client, I need to be in person for that, you know. So anyway. Then that Friday, my campus president sent out an email and said, I believe that the threat from, so remember, just Monday,
right.
They were all like,
it's cool, wash your hands.
Yeah, just wash your hands. Just distance you. This is Friday of that week. I believe that the threat from the virus itself is manageable, and as a campus, we are in a good position to minimize transmission. We tend not to be... Oh, so actually, this is still in that zone. My department, my boss, is actually... The New York Times, the daily podcast, has me freaked out. I really do think we should go over Zoom, but my campus president is still like, everything's fine. And as a campus, we are in a good position to minimize transmission. We tend not to be densely populated, and we are not a residential campus. Our classrooms are clean and have been repeatedly sanitized, and there have been no verified reports of anyone with the virus on campus. So what do you think about that statement?
Interesting. Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's funny. Again, how many days later? It's the first announcement was... There was a gap of 3 days between the first announcement and the second one.
So this is Friday. So Monday was everything's fine, but some students are concerned. And I had actually already switched to online.
Right.
Then on that Friday, you still have the president basically elaborating on that and being like, there's not a threat. It can be managed. We can still have in-person classes. We just need to do a little bit extra to make sure that everything's fine. Plus, we don't have any reports of...
And who's the person that sent the one
that
saying...
That was my boss.
That was your boss.
That's a professor.
So now there's also, unfortunately, some mixed messaging happening, right?
So my boss is directly connected to me. And then my boss's boss is the president.
I can see some pressure at the highest levels of all the organizations of like not trying to freak people out. And just that facing that reality of like, so what? So we're just going to shut down? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like, when do we pull that trigger?
When have we? We've never done that.
We've never pulled that trigger.
Yeah, I think it was, there's always this anxiety of, I don't know, but I would guess that there was an anxiety of, if we actually take precautions and shut down the campus, might our product quality go down, and thus people will drop out of school, or they'll stop wanting to come here, and then we will lose money, and then we're already having budget problems. I mean, I can't tell you what thin margin my university is right now. Like, small universities that don't have huge endowments are, I mean, I was on the budgeting committee of my university, and I knew the numbers, and on good years, we worry just moderately.
Yeah.
On bad years, it's like, the whole system is going to come crashing down in 6 months, because we can't, we don't know how we're going to raise the money to pay for, you know, and then you have to start laying people off.
So then the thought that's like, oh yeah, I guess we got to not do classes.
Right. So there's always this terror about not providing a good service so that your customers, your students are satisfied, to the point where a lot of the upper administration, when we as a program take action against a student, because the 1 out of 1,000 students that we admit in who demonstrates to have too much impairment or too much problem ethically or something to be a viable candidate for the degree and a viable candidate as a clinician, we will gatekeep and remove them from the program, kick them out of the program. And upper administration has had varying levels of support of that. Mm. We don't do that lightly. And if anything, we should probably do it twice as often as we do.
Sure.
There, you know, I would say that for every one person we actually do kick out, there's another person that should have been kicked out that we didn't kick out, you know, because of the amount of anxiety and lack of know-how on behalf of professors sometimes. So,
but there's that fear that, like, if
but upper administration would pressure us and sometimes override us and force us to keep the student in, even though the student has been repeatedly given chances to.
And is that because they don't want the university to be seen as too hard or something? Or,
you know, I can't get in their head, but usually they're just completely obsessed and motivated by money. And if a student is kicked out, then they stop paying tuition. And if they sue us, then it costs a lot for legal fees.
Right, right.
And I'm just like, that's just a part of operation costs, and figure it out. You know, we're not giving people a degree in like math. We're giving people a clinical stamp of approval that they can provide clinical services for other human beings. And at the very least, you should be worried, administration, about the hit to our reputation if it gets out that we're just graduating everybody, and then it could look like any graduate from our program could have a problem. You know what I mean? Because you know that big corporations, Amazon, these other places, were also worried about that, right?
Oh, like, totally.
If we send people home, productivity will go down. Yeah. Our bottom line will go down.
Especially because, I mean, it's just a common notion. If people are not monitored 24/7, they don't work. They don't do anything.
Yeah. But let's take a break. When we get back, let's continue. What do you say, bro?
Let's do it.
Okay, so March 24th, Trump had the following quote. "We've never closed down the country for the flu, so you say to yourself, what is this all about?" The next day, March 25th, Trump says, "The faster we go back, the better it's going to be." KUOW, a local radio station, you know, the University of Washington, our alma mater, they announced that they would no longer be broadcasting Trump's briefing of the coronavirus, quote, "due to a pattern of false and misleading information provided that cannot be fact-checked in real time." Do you remember this?
I do, yeah.
It wasn't just KUW, it was a lot of places.
Yeah, it was a lot of places.
Like TV stations stopped airing his briefings.
Yeah.
Because he was saying all this ridiculous stuff.
Right.
I mean, just imagine that.
And that was before lawsuits, because obviously, you know, eventually places got sued for misinformation, but that was before all that.
Yeah.
So they were like, whoa, we got to be responsible here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just imagine that
the president of the country
yeah,
is not trustworthy.
Because, you know, at these radio stations and TV stations, there were times when various different presidents would say things that the viewership or the publication would think were problematic, you know?
Right, right.
But they wouldn't essentially censor the individual, because they're like, well, if the president wants to hang themselves out to dry, then fine. But at this point, what Trump was doing was so dangerous and deadly.
Right.
I mean, the deaths on that man's hands. Just contemplate that for a second. Yeah. The amount of people who are dead partially because of him.
Yeah.
It's just, how do you sleep at night?
Yep.
You're the leader of a country. You are supposed to be on our side, not your own side, so that you can keep the quote unquote the economy going and thus get reelected. God, it's just really just depressing. Okay.
And it's, there was a lot of enablement around him, you know?
Yeah.
A lot. So he,
well, but he, also I heard from insiders, and who knows, that behind closed doors, a lot of his advisors were actually arguing with them kind of about this. They were saying, and presumably what I understand is behind closed doors, he was a little bit more open to hearing the truth, right? He wouldn't necessarily act on it, but he wouldn't like just fire someone if someone came out and said, Mr. President, this is going to be a big deal and a lot of people are going to die and maybe you should be helping that or, you know. So he was being repeatedly told, he was being briefed by the scientists, Fauci, others, and no one was opposing that. It wasn't like there was some other doctor that he was being advised by that was saying, this
is not doctors, but other people, including like, media celebrities and other advisors that were telling him, if you shut down the country, you know, it's, you won't get reelected.
Yeah.
By the way, March 25. So on March 26th, I made a post on Facebook. Socialism sounds naive, unrealistic, and scary until nature punches you in the capitalisms. It was basically this feeling I had of like, yeah, sometimes I kind of want a government that can like do stuff and not just let the free markets, you know, save everyone. Because I think at this time in my neighborhood Facebook groups, people were literally saying, this is why I never trust the government. Everyone should just be out for themselves. And so, you know, there are all these debates raging where there are all these libertarians coming out of the woodwork going like, hey, if you're not ready for an emergency like this, it's on you, blah, blah, blah. You know, like this naive notion, like we still live in, you know, 600 years ago or something where you.
Well, what are they advocating for exactly?
They're like, first of all, you know, you shouldn't be surprised if their infrastructure is not ready to handle things. If you're not already stocked up ahead of time, it's your own fault. Basically that you should never trust the government or depend on the government for anything. It's all up to you. It's all up to every individual. And it's kind of this libertarian notion of we should have just, you know, no, as little government as possible and just let each person fend for themselves.
So there should be no regulation, no shutdown, that kind of thing?
Certainly that, as well as don't expect the government to come and save us. You know, just everyone out for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that, hence why I made this post, because I was so frustrated. I was like, yeah, no.
So this is when I believe one of the first person that, well, the first people that I knew kind of died from COVID, the grandma at Kona Kitchen, the restaurant.
Oh, she died of COVID?
Yeah. And
oh no.
Yeah. And she's, again, one of the only people that, and I didn't really know her. I just knew of her. I'd seen her before, but yeah, she died. The Washington State Parks, National Forests, and National Parks were all closed in Washington. At this point, I remember there was a lot of communication in my family around this time. Did you have that too?
Oh, yeah. Especially with my Colombian relatives.
Yeah, I just remember it was just like all day long, everyone checking in. How you doing? Is anyone sick?
Yeah.
Are you...
What's happening?
Are you isolating? Yeah. Does anyone need anything? And also a lot of maybe just even... It's interesting to look back on that psychologically. I think it was when we're scared and uncertain, you just want, it's sort of like when it snows out in Seattle, which it doesn't happen very often. There's often a lot of communication in my family,
right?
My parents, yeah. My siblings, like,
it's an unusual event.
Yeah. How much snow do you have? Or did you have to drive anywhere? Or there's just a lot of, you know, it must be comforting somehow to return to your secure base and just check in with people.
Yeah.
When everything's scary. It also just felt like, well, we're all sharing in this experience. So it just felt natural to check totally. In and share experiences with each other.
Yeah. And I was talking to my Colombian relatives, especially including my dad and my grandparents, because, you know, they were freaking out about what was happening up here. And I was starting to worry, like, once it hits there, what's going to happen? Because it hadn't really hit there yet. It was starting to, but it hadn't really hit yet there. And I was thinking, man, if we're having trouble, what's going to happen in Colombia?
Yeah.
Ironically, their response was far superior initially to the thing.
This is when I, on this day, March 25th, was when I posted my very first Love is Blind reaction video. In my mind, from my memory, as soon as, because this is a turning point in all of our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, mainly me and my wife, but really all of us. I mean.
But I thought that this was way later, like, no. I don't know, in the summer or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No. It was right here. Because as soon as things shut down for just some random reason, and yeah. I never watch reality TV. Up until this point, I had only watched reality TV as a result of other people I knew watching it and sort of roping me in. Like, I watched a season of Rock of Love, I think second season Rock of Love with Vince Neil. Another season of like some other pop, I think it was literally just called Pop Star or something, where a bunch of women vied to try to become a part of a girl singing group, you know?
Okay.
Oh, I watched Real World season one because everyone did on MTV in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Never watched Survivor.
See, I'm kind of the opposite.
Never watched Bachelorette. Never watched Bachelor. Never heard of 90 Day Fiancé. Never watched any of the Real Housewives. Never watched, you know, like, I didn't watch Big Brother. I didn't watch any of it ever, because to me it was just completely not my thing.
Yeah.
So why did I decide at the beginning of the pandemic, when everyone's like, well, we might as well binge something, like, why in the world? And because I was the one that said to Stacey, let's watch this. And what if I'd never watched? Like, my entire life is just completely different. You know, most of the people listening right now would have never heard about the podcast if I hadn't done this random thing.
So random watching.
So then I posted on March 25th, totally thinking, look, this isn't going to go anywhere, because nothing I ever do goes anywhere big. But, you know, maybe by the core fans at the time. Usually I'd get about like 800 views on YouTube or something, maybe 1,000. But my very first video with Love is Blind reaction, I got 2,500 views.
Wow.
In the first week, and right. I was like, whoa, okay.
Well, this is going somewhere.
Yeah, like, in my mind, that was a huge success. It didn't really matter that much. I think that equates to, well, maybe like $20 or $10 or something, you know what I mean?
But it was still, like, you know, in terms of views and people seeing it.
Right, which is always what I was going for at that point. So 2,500 views, I was like, oh, okay, interesting. And in my mind, as soon as I published it, from my memory, as soon as I published it, it instantly took off because it was an instant hit. But it wasn't. For the first week, it just got that regular kind of bump from probably just my core audience. Yeah. You know what I mean? So then,
right? Because how would it get recommended yet? Or
The algorithm hadn't tagged it yet. So March 26th. The third relief bill is passed by the U.S. Congress. Seattle encourages residents to make a joyful noise at 8 p.m. in support of the frontline workers. Do you remember this?
No. I don't remember that.
Wow. I do. Do you not remember different cities around maybe the world, but in the States, we would all, like, I remember there was something that would go on in New York City where people would hang out their window and everyone would scream at midnight or something. I can't remember what it was, but
this whole thing missed me.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cause everyone was stuck at home. Right. Yeah. So it's another part of this psychology aspect of, we were forcing ourselves to stay home. And, you know, for the vast majority of us, we're okay with that. But we missed other human beings. You know, I think we, and I did too, right. I think completely underestimated how bad that would be. Like, if you would have told me before the pandemic, look, there's going to be a time in the future when you will be forced to stay home and you don't have to go to work anymore. You can work from home. You don't have to deal with stupid shit anymore. You don't want to deal with, you know what I mean? I would have been like, yeah, sign me up. It's like a staycation, right? But we instantly longed for connection with even strangers or people we barely knew. And so there was this movement to connect somehow at an extreme distance in neighborhoods by like walking out in the street and making a lot of noise. And that was a thing that happened. And it's also funny to think back on a lot of the things that were going on in March and April and how that all kind of fizzled out, you know, because the pandemic went on for so long that a lot of these, like the constant communication with my family.
You can't keep that up.
Well, it also just became, it really felt to me how bad communicating over Zoom is, how hard it is, you know, in a social setting when you have a group of people. You can hold a meeting over Zoom, right? You can hold a class over Zoom, but if you have 15 family members, everyone trying to talk at the same time, which is normal, you know, when you're in a room together,
it's not the same.
Yeah, people taking turns trying to say something and barely understanding each other. And so that's another one of those things that was kind of pleasant in the beginning, and then over time we just like, never mind, I don't want to do this quote unquote joyful noise at 8 p.m. Also, at this point, March 26, ventilators and beds are becoming scarce. Trump has a tweet or a comment here, quote, I don't believe you need... So this is him actually responding to states that are calling for federal help to get ventilators. I don't believe you need 40,000 or 30,000 ventilators. You go into major hospitals sometimes and they'll have two ventilators. And now all of a sudden they're saying, can we order 30,000 ventilators?
Jeez.
I mean, just... it's like, what do you think is happening, Donald Trump, that these hospitals are, what, like, making it up?
Is coupling the total lack of understanding of anything with the idea that he has the full understanding of everything.
Yeah. You know, I would understand if he said something like, look, that's not going to happen because we don't have those ventilators, or we don't have the funds for that, or that's going to be fine. You know, if there's a difficulty.
I've authorized the emergency authorization, but whatever, to start producing more ventilators.
Or even a political statement of, we're absolutely dedicated to helping hospitals and we will do everything we can. And then behind closed doors, you do what you got to do. But publicly, he's stating at this point, what hospitals now all of a sudden they need all these ventilators? What's wrong? You know, basically accusing hospitals of lying.
Well, because he thinks since he's constantly conning, so he just assumes everyone else is always conning.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
This crazy projection, like, you must be trying to con me.
Yeah,
every interaction is always someone trying to con him.
And what's the fucking con, Trump, that these hospitals are going to turn around and sell the ventilators that they've purchased?
Right, because obviously the ventilators are really useful when you're not in a COVID pandemic.
So dumb. Okay, so next day, March 27th, the U.S. confirmed at least 100,000 cases of COVID, meaning I think it was like an estimate. It wasn't the amount of positive tests, because, of course, we didn't have tests to give. But there was an estimate of 100,000 cases.
Which, I think, wasn't that from like hospitals reporting in and they kind of like guesstimated from there?
Yeah, I think it was like a John Hopkins study or something. And at least that's my thought. But the notable thing about this is that we had more cases than China and Italy, because that was, up until that point, considered to be the two epicenters. The two hot zones were China, obviously, and then Italy. Do we ever figure out why Italy became one of the very first hot spots?
No, I mean, someone must have, but I don't remember. Like, I just
did a lot of people from Wuhan just go to Italy or something? I don't know.
I don't remember. I do know that it was they had poorer infrastructure than some of the other European countries.
Yeah.
But
that doesn't explain why it would spread so fast. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just kind of weird. The U.S. death toll at this point was 1,500, which sounds utterly quaint. It's very still quaint. 1,500 people that are dead, but still it's just like...
Yeah.
Oh boy, you know, get ready because, you know, it'll be...
And I remember at the time...
1,000 times that.
Yeah. I remember at the time, there were people saying, oh yeah, we might get to like 100,000 deaths.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that. I actually started making predictions because I have this list where I'll like... It's just a little fun little thing. I like to figure out how stupid I am by making predictions.
I see.
And then, but trying legit to predict things and then actually being wrong. Unemployment climbs. It just skyrockets. It you know, it goes from 3% to 15%.
Jeez.
Yeah. Because, you know, restaurants basically closing down. And so they probably soon fire everybody.
Because you were talking about that whole thing with the university, how... Well, most businesses out there, small businesses, don't have runway at all.
Yeah.
They're like, if we don't get the money this week from the people that pay us in cash every day, we close.
Yeah, and restaurants are almost always in that situation. Yeah. So, yeah. March 28, Trump, he starts bragging about getting high ratings for his COVID briefings.
It was actually on the 29th. The tweet was on the 29th.
Okay.
He posts a thing that says... President Trump is a ratings hit. Since reviving the daily White House briefing, this is a quote he posted. Yeah. Mr. Trump and his coronavirus updates have attracted an average audience of 8.5 million on cable news, roughly the viewership of the season finale of The Bachelor. Numbers are continuing to rise. Oh, my comment, by the way, was Bret Easton Ellis' characters are unrealistically psychopathic and narcissistic.
Yeah, you couldn't... Right, if you wrote that into a movie, like Idiocracy or something, you'd be like...
Come on.
Yeah.
Now you're just getting stupid.
That's just cartoonish.
Yeah.
That someone would say that, one. Two, that they would think it's because of them, that they're entertaining.
It would have to be...
Instead of... Any idiot would know. And this is why I think Trump is like legit not very smart, because there's narcissism... And then there's narcissism plus lack of IQ, which is like,
dude.
You can't draw A and B together. That, well, I know I feel this way, but what people will think is that, one, I'm bragging during a pandemic, and two,
oh my gosh,
the reason why people are tuning in possibly is because they're terrified about dying, and we are providing presumably good science to help them save their own lives, not... I'm the most entertaining person on the planet. That's why everyone's tuning in.
It's just so mind-numbing. And what's crazy is not only is the thought going through his head, he posts it for the world to see.
Yeah.
Which goes back to the whole like lack of awareness of... But in all fairness, it works for his supporters.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a break and go back. And when we come back, we'll continue. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay, so continue with March 28th. Medics from the U.S. Army converted Seahawks Stadium into a medical hospital. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do remember this, yeah.
Because the thought was we were doomed to have thousands of patients.
We're going to have these makeshift beds. And
because it was happening in other communities. And I didn't know this until I looked it up while researching this, but... Did you know we never used it? We never had to.
I didn't
to.
Know that. Actually.
We never had to use it because we flattened the curve in Seattle so well, in Western Washington so well, that we actually effectively managed to keep the amount of patients in our hospitals
That's great.
Relatively low, so we didn't have to use this MASH unit, if you will, because it was never used and it was dismantled soon after. I also remember around this time, you know, Hot Ones, the YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Where they,
eat the spicy wings.
The spicy wings. Well, Sean Evans, the host, at some point, he talks about how he got COVID.
At this early? Like, he got it this early?
It was pretty early on, yeah. Because I remember hearing his description of it and thinking, oh my God. So he talks about how he got COVID and he lives by himself in, I think, New York City. I'm not sure. Maybe, well, probably LA. Anyway, he said that one night, you know, he couldn't sleep and he gets up out of bed in the middle of the night and he is walking to get a glass of water or something. And he says he passed out and hit his head on the coffee table. And he wakes up in a pool of blood.
Oh, my God.
And he's just like, what happened? You know, imagine that.
Yeah.
You're all alone. The hospitals are clogged up. And you just pass out.
Oh, my God. See, that's what was one of the freaky things is in the early days with the Wuhan videos, there were these videos of people on the street just falling over. And you're like, what's that? Like, that's, we've not seen that before.
Right.
And I guess, you know, maybe low oxygenation or who knows what. And just
right. Low oxygenation and you stand up too fast.
Jeez.
And no blood to the brain, no oxygen to the brain. And
that's brutal.
Yeah. March 29, Dr. Fauci warns that the coronavirus may infect millions of Americans and could kill 100,000 to 200,000 people.
Right.
So that was right. those initial estimates. Right.
And you know, I look back because I remember was seeing those briefings. Him and a lot of those folk always looked very nervous, not just about the fact that the pandemic was happening, but about what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And the impression I got was that they were constantly being yelled at and warned, like, you know, if you think, yeah. Like, don't say that. No, don't say that. Don't freak them out. Don't.
Yeah, well, <You know? laughs> I remember these briefings because Trump would talk in his way,
right,
and then would
they look all uncomfortable,
and then Dr. Fauci and others yeah. would get to the podium and Trump would be just off camera.
Yeah,
I remember thinking, like, yeah, I mean, your boss, the boss of all bosses, right. is right there, obviously coming from a different place, and yet you have to, as a scientist, report the science.
Oh my God.
And so I remember that it was a really awkward. And I remember being so proud of Dr. Fauci, and I really have been the whole time. The amount of professionalism right. and his effective medical scientific communication, you know, I don't think we could have asked for no. a better, more.
And in the midst of being called names and demonized threats to his life, yeah. everything.
Yeah. People think he's to blame for killing him.
He's the one who started.
Yeah. I think some politicians literally believe he
did. Do you know that the latest crazy inane thing that I was hearing was that they had some sort of Mar-a-Lago event where Trump was eulogizing someone or whatever. This was just last weekend. And the lady that was speaking was saying, they released the vaccine so that it would spread among everyone so that it would kill everyone. You know, basically, like, it's not the virus that could kill everyone. It's the vaccine that would spread and kill everyone. It's like, ah!
Yeah. Yeah. We have science and observation. We can answer that question. We know the answer. And, you know, scientists, when they develop a vaccine, they have those questions. Are there bad effects? Will it actually cause illness? Will an illness spread? And what they do is they do small trials and they start branching it out from there. It's usually an animal trial, and, you know, and you just keep gathering data and tabulating the data, reporting on the data. They found that it, on the average, it was vastly lower in risks to have the vaccine as opposed to not having the vaccine.
Sorry,
it's just science. It's fucking data. It's like walking out your door, looking up to the sky, seeing rain and saying, it's not fucking raining.
There's only been 13 billion shots.
You can't just, scientists don't just make shit up. Now, occasionally they do, but, you know, not in this scenario, especially when you're involving literally thousands of institutions in every country and thousands, you know, maybe millions of medical professionals and scientists.
But how can you be sure? There's only been 13 billion shots around the world.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. They're actually saying it's spreading, that it, because they use all these buzzwords now, the gain of function. Have you heard the gain of function?
No, I don't I don't consume their rhetoric because I think it, one, makes them more powerful for me to pay attention, and two, it's useless to pay attention.
It's completely, but yeah.
Because that's how Trump got elected, was because he would say crazy shit and yep. you and I would react against it. And Republicans who hate people like you and I thought, oh my God, Trump is the best. And so that's why I don't pay attention to any of those fuckers anymore, because that's what they want, because that's what they know, because owning the libs is all that a certain section of our society wants. That's all they base their life on, is who's owning the libs. I don't care what they're owning them for. I just want them to own them. You support Ukraine, you know, usually Republicans hated Russians, by the way, right? I mean,
we have whole movies about it.
Ronald Reagan. Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger. What's his face from Texas? Texas Ranger.
Yeah. Chuck Norris.
I mean, every one of his movies was anti-communism, anti-Russia. And now, because Russia has invaded Ukraine and people, regardless of their partisanship, are in support of victims of invasion, there are many Republicans that are just pro-Russia because we are perceived to be... It's not a partisan issue. It's just unfair for a country to invade another. And but don't you worry that they might invade us? Like, they're just invading. It's not okay for no reason. No, if there was even the shred of a legitimate reason.
But it's so simple. Like, the narrative is so simple. But Putin was friends with Trump, and apparently Biden's doing all sorts of shady stuff with Ukraine. Hence, we hate Ukraine, and Russia's in the right.
Yeah, and for the record, if Biden's doing shady stuff with Ukraine, then by all means, let's find that out and put a stop to it.
Investigate corrupt politicians.
All sorts of politicians are corrupt. Is Biden one of them? Could be. Let's look into it. There's a section of our audience that are pro-Russia, and they'll yell at me when I talk about being pro-Ukraine.
Sure.
And I'm not pro-Ukraine. I'm just... Because Ukraine has problems, and it has historically had problems.
Right.
Every country has problems, and Ukraine is one of those countries that has problems. So I'm not saying I support everything Zelensky or the Ukrainian government has ever done. That's ridiculous. What I'm saying is that it's not okay to invade and kill thousands upon thousands, not only of Ukrainians, but Putin has put over 100,000 of his own people to death for this... For what?
Yeah.
For what? So I get amped up about this because there's inevitably always someone that will go after me and say, like, well, you don't understand the situation. And what I'll say is, okay, granted, but are you saying that it's justified to invade another country and kill innocent people? Is that what you're contending?
Right.
Because, sure, I might not understand the full situation, but I'm pretty sure there's no justification for killing innocent people. Okay. The other thing is I know there are people listening right now that literally believe the vaccine is wrong. I mean, every time I talk about it, particularly back during this time when I was...
Yeah, totally.
People would... Long emails. Yeah. Smart people with, quote-unquote, research to back them up, telling me about how bad the vaccines are.
Right.
And it's just... It's maddening.
Hey, look. Guess what? I was worried when the vaccines got developed quickly and by the Trump administration, I was certainly not like gunning to like get my shot. But at the same time, I'm like, but dude, like, this is not one institution. This is not one company. This isn't one scientist. A. B. Like, we have a pandemic that's worldwide. It's shut everything down. It's killing millions of people. So, and then, you know, after the first shot and everyone was okay, it's like, okay.
Well, not only that, but they had already done plenty of trials.
Of course they had. But I'm saying, like, you know, just in my experience with drugs and medicine in the last few years, I've realized, okay, stuff can still have side effects. Stuff can still be not well understood. All these things. Fine. As an example, I did a trial for a medicine that was brand recently approved, but it had been sort of like rush approved by the FDA because it was for some serious complications and blah, blah. I didn't have a good reaction to it.
For your thyroid.
Yeah, well, it was related. It was sort of the Graves' disease. I didn't have a good reaction to the drug. But that happens. These things happen. But it's not a big conspiracy. I mean, sure, there's money floating around in big companies and stuff like that. But it isn't like this, how do we end the world? Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to fake a virus. The virus itself won't kill everyone, but it will make us be able to inject everyone with something that... Now, someone raises their hand. How come the virus can't be the one that kills everyone? Why don't we make the virus kill everyone? That's too simple.
Yeah.
We got to make the vaccine.
Yeah.
And the vaccine was going to have a gain of function, which doesn't belong to the vaccine. That's the virus thing, but you're going to get it wrong. It's like, ah!
Yeah. And it's ridiculous. And it's all based on... this essentially dogmatic religion that liberals are always wrong.
Yeah.
And so anything that a liberal thinks is always wrong. And well, then and there must be some other answer, and they will come up with fantastical, quote unquote, answers to adhere to that notion. And it's just like, look, you can hate me because I'm a liberal, fine, but don't hate the scientists because they're not partisan.
But here was the start of it. So getting back to our dateline or our timeline here, this is the start of it where, again, this could have been a positive thing. Mm-hmm. Trump could have been like, look at these amazing people I have who have like been, you know, they know the science and I am here representing them because I have their back and I'm so great for having their back. Great, fine. Brag all you want.
Yeah.
And that could have been a great thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, let's listen to the science. You know, America was built with science, whatever, you know, like just make it a jingoistic thing. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Just make it work for you and for the people. Mm-hmm. And instead it's this like schizophrenia starts happening, no offense, where it's like...
It's not schizophrenia. Stop saying that.
Sorry.
It's two-faced. Just say two-faced.
This two-faced thing starts happening where it's like, I've developed the vaccines, but you shouldn't take them, but I'm going to take it, but it doesn't do any good. But it does do good. But it does.
Yeah, I think... I remember thinking, it's been a while since I've had to deal with Trump, but I remember now his seeming stuck, because, you know, you and I would often just hear the ridiculous things he would say.
Yeah.
But he would also say things that I could agree with.
Totally.
So I think his overall political style, which you could argue is very savvy, and I could argue that he does it in a very savvy manner, that he says so many things and so many contradictory things, but for the people who want to be in the cult of Donald Trump, every one of them will hear something that will soothe them or be in agreement or in alignment with how they think. So for the anti-vaxxers, they hear him and they're like, that's our man.
Right.
And for the Republicans who are anti-liberal but are pro-science and pro-vaccination, Trump will also say things that will satisfy them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. He developed the vaccine.
Or yeah. Yeah. Trump would just say so many things, and the way he would word it, it was always possible to kind of, not always, but it was often possible for him to kind of worm his way out of it, you know, because he wouldn't say things definitively often.
Right.
And there was just all these little signals, you know, like when he said stand up or stand down or whatever the fuck to the goddamn Proud Boys or those toxic
that's
idiots.
That's exactly what he said.
To the vast majority of Republicans.
Stand back and stand by.
to the vast majority of Republicans who probably have no idea what that even refers to, it doesn't bother them. But to the few people who do understand it, it a billion percent adheres those individuals to the cult of Trump.
Right.
You know what I mean? So during the pandemic, we're highlighting the idiot things he was saying, but he said a lot of things. And yeah.
Take the shutdowns. This is an interesting one. Imagine you take this angle like, all those commie libs all these years made fun of us for stockpiling our weapons, stockpiling some supplies and being self-sufficient in the traditional American way. Ha! Who's laughing now? Because you know you're going to be able to survive just fine with a few weeks of shutdown. Mm-hmm. Whereas those Libby commies in their big cities, you're going to be like, I wish my toilet paper. You could totally play it up.
Yeah. There's an asshole Trumpian version of this that could have been absolutely in alignment with trying to reduce Americans from dying.
Exactly. And the libs wouldn't have cared. Oh, you called me names. Big deal. And his side would have been like, that's right. We're going to show the libs we're better. Right. But instead it's like oh no, we can't have, this will mean no re-election. So yeah, shutdowns are stupid.
Yeah. He could have easily tried to engineer a situation where the science and the truth was on his side, and he could have created a, as you were, you know, role-playing, a straw man of the libs as being the wrong people,
right.
You know, the people who don't, you know, he could say, look, you have to stay home. And then you could point to someone that must be a liberal who's leaving their house, that privileged liberal or whatever.
And obviously I don't like the idea that you would still demonize the other side. But what I'm trying to get across,
I would have rather had him do that.
Right.
Then that would have saved lives.
Yes.
Innocent Americans.
My point is you can maintain your ridiculous narrative and still try to save the lives.
Right. March 30th, I watched Tiger King.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of another narcissistic idiot. Trump had another tweet here or statement.
I can't believe how long ago that was.
Yeah. I know. I don't. To my memory, Tiger King was well into the pandemic, yeah. But a lot of things happened in March.
Yeah.
Love is Blind, Tiger King, shut down. You know, Trump said, stay calm. It'll go away. You know it. You know it is going away, and it will go away, and we're going to have a great victory. Stay calm. It'll go away. You know it. You know it is going away, and it will go away, and we're all going to have a great victory.
I mean, that itself, it's like, okay. I mean, obviously, it's over-promising, but
it's in alignment with all of his statements of there's nothing to worry about. Go back to work.
Ah, yes, yes.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
At some point, Trump called the coronavirus a hoax. Do you remember this?
Yeah, oh, yes.
Created by the Democrats. He says it early on, by the way.
But he had already been using the China virus thing, right?
I think that was a little later.
Okay.
But in his very coded way, but basically saying, and it was clear to everyone what he was saying, was that the Democrats were creating a hoax of the coronavirus. Now, I think what he would defensively say later on would be something like, I was referring to the fact that Democrats will use anything against me.
Yeah, the weaponization of the virus against me.
But when you are the leader of our country and you're in that position and you start throwing around the word coronavirus is a hoax created by the Democrats, then there's going to be a whole swath of people that are going to hear that and think, and because there were people, this was QAnon time, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so there was, people literally thought that Trump was a mega genius who had his finger in every situation and knew everything about everything, knew the true information about this massive cabal of conspiracy theories. And when you hear him say a hoax created by the Democrats, there's a whole group of people that are like, oh, well, yeah, obviously the coronavirus is completely faked and there is no such thing. And the Democrats are trying to trick us into believing that it is a real thing. And a lot of people believe that.
I mean, COVID was such a boon to so many cults and conspiracy theorists, right? Because the whole time they're in their basement waiting for these terrible things to happen, right? And then all of a sudden the world shuts down with a terrible world of the end of the world virus. They're like, I knew it.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, fill in whatever conspiracy crazy thing. That was real.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're operating from the paranoid assumption that the government, especially the Democrats or whatever, are always up to no good, then yeah, this is right up your alley. This is your wet dream, essentially. Yep. All right. On that note, Berto, let's end chapter 4. And when we return next episode, we'll do chapter 5. And we will start April, finally.
Woo-hoo!
We're finally done with March. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
Everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.